Well, this is the Livingston Bicentennial, and we're going to be dealing with the extraordinary life and the legacy of Dr. David Livingston. A lot of people say, why do we bother with history? What is the point? And many people have a very negative view of history because maybe they had a bad experience at school, a boring teacher, some very tedious textbooks, you know, just dead people and dates, and I've heard people being very negative about history. And that's a great pity, because history tells us what has worked, and history tells us what has not worked. We need to develop the ability to recognize these lessons in every area of life. I'm interested in history because I'm concerned for the future. And if we understand our past well, we can make a better future by working in the present, things that we can learn from in the past. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, surely one of the greatest Russians and the most celebrated Russian author of the 20th century, he said, if we do not know our own history, we will simply have to endure all the same mistakes, sacrifices, and absurdities all over again. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. To be ignorant of what has happened before you were born is to remain a child forever, said Cicero. It is not the remembered past, but a forgotten past that enslaves us, said C.S. Lewis. Some people say the past can enslave you. Well, if you forget your past, yes, it can enslave you. But if you remember it and learn the lessons in the light of Scripture, in the light of Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26 and Jeremiah 18, how God judges nations, God blesses nations that obey His law, and God brings negative consequences to nations that disobey His law, and that God is working all things together for good for those who love Him and are called according to His purpose. Goethe said, none are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe that they are free. You want some examples of why we need to know our history? Have you noticed what's happened in the last week? Lots of homes of Christians have been destroyed in Pakistan. Just Muslims going on a rampage, cheerfully posing for the camera, while they burn homes, churches, businesses of Christians. We've had people say, the Arab Spring, this is just tremendous, this is wonderful, this is magnificent. But in fact, the Arab Spring is just actually a Christian winter. And remember, a resurgence of radical Islam is going to bring greater oppression to women. That's in fact what happens. And this is a pretty good picture of what the Arab Spring really is. It's not a spring at all. It's a deadly, bitter winter. It's brought severe abuse to women and persecution of the church. Here's a 16-year-old sentenced to death for being raped in Iran. And that's the way it works. This is what happens in Muslim countries like Pakistan and Iran. They execute the victim. This woman in Syria was shot, tied to a post with spit on her, or you have no honor, written on the ground, and she was shot because she was found drunk. Drunk could mean that she'd had a drink, whatever it was. But the people who did this are the rebels who are getting all the support from the West right now. And so think of how the Arab Spring and Sharia law actually implicates people and what involves it. Winston Churchill said, the influence of the Islamic religion paralyzes the social development of those who follow it. No stronger retrograde force exists in the world. They seem such calm, rational, reasonable people. The problem is just that we don't understand them. Freedom of expression go to hell. This is somebody in England making use of the freedom of expression in England to say freedom of expression go to hell. Something ironic about that. Here on the left you can see in Britain, proud to be a British Muslim, islamispeace.org.uk, and on the right another British double-decker red bus blown to pieces by the 7/7 bombers. If Islam is a religion of peace, then sticks of dynamite are only candles. To show you how people's ignorance of history can lead to unbelievable stupidity, here are British school children being yoked up and chained as part of some school practical to commemorate the 200th anniversary of the abolition of the slave trade. Now, you would have thought they'd be celebrating 200 years ago Christians brought into the slave trade, but no, they had idiots doing things like this, wearing I'm so sorry t-shirts, and walking around with chains and yokes, and having people at the steps of the church bend down, people who never did the crime, apologizing to people who weren't the victim. What's this proof, aside from imbecility and lack of knowledge of history? apparently race does not exist, but white people are evil. If that makes any sense to somebody. And so here's some poor soul who's got a horribly crippled mind and knowledge of history that he's in Hull, which, by the way, is one of the places in England where the evangelicals mobilized to end the slave trade over 200 years ago. And he's chained himself and he's kneeling on the ground saying so sorry on his t-shirt. He should be praising God for this victory of the church in defeating slavery 200 years ago and fighting against the slave trade that's going on today, which is far more relevant, let's say. Why are they marching in England with no borders, no nations, stop deportations? Are they marching in Saudi Arabia with this? Actually, it's no borders, no white nations, stop deportations is more accurate. Can you guess what the agenda is? British police go to hell. Islam will dominate the world. British soldiers burn in hell. Sharia will dominate the world. These are people protesting in London. And the people in London are putting up with this because they don't know the history. And now you've got the London Fatwa Council, Islamic Legal Advice Centre. What on earth would you want a fatwa council for in a country that knows freedom and has some of the finest heritage of laws going back to the common law of King Alfred the Great, based on the Ten Commandments? Why would you want this primitive, 7th century, barbaric, misogynist, anti-woman, tribal brutality that passes for fatwas and Sharia law in a civilized country? So this is what multiculturalism has brought, a real suicide bomb. What if he's an Islamicist? So what? Who are we to judge? It's arrogant to think that our culture is superior. It's bigoted to criticize his religion. Don't stare at him, son, you might offend him. I mean, this is what it's come to. There are people out there who are bludgeoning Christians to death, and multiculturalism is neutralizing opposition. It's a philosophy of self-destruction, producing catastrophic events of biblical proportion for generations, a la the Tower of Babel. What are the consequences going to be of people pretending that Islam is a peaceful and tolerant religion? What is going to happen in these countries as millions and millions of these Muslims continue to multiply? Here in Sweden, Muslims are only about 5% of the population. They all live on welfare, but they can still gather and show their appreciation for the generosity and hospitality of the Swedes by burning their flag. They tell us their plans. Freedom can go to hell, Islam will dominate the world, but the governments keep saying, and the media keep saying, they're peaceful and tolerant religion. Can you guess where this is? London, of course. One of the afterlives we should be concerned about is the future we're going to leave our children. What are the consequences going to be for Western civilization? If you want to know what the consequences are going to be, look at Turkey, which used to be the Byzantine Christian Empire. Look at North Africa, which used to be Christian nations. 1 Corinthians 10 verse 6 says, now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things. Everything in biblical history and everything in our national history should be an example for us to learn from, so that we would not set our hearts on evil things, which includes cowardice. History is and must ever continue to be, next to God's word, the richest foundation of wisdom and the surest guide to all successful practical activity. The longer you look back, the further you can look forward. Histories are a true school for learning how to order our lives. And that's why we're focused on the Reformation Society and victorious Christians who changed the world, one of which is Dr. David Livingstone, who we will focus on tonight. These heroes of the faith give us examples of excellence. They help us to understand the times in which they live, and therefore to better understand our times. And we understand what God blessed, and therefore we can understand what God will bless in the future. And history is moving towards a culmination, when the kingdoms of this world will become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. All nations will come and worship before the Lord, but right now the church is plainly in a wilderness wandering, such as you read about in the book of Numbers, not having the faith to enter the promised land to fulfill the great commission and win the nations for Christ. We're wandering in the wilderness until God can raise up a generation that will honor him and be bold and take the land. And David Livingstone was one of those generation that took the land for Christ. All over the world, there are countries and cities organizing Livingstone 200s, Livingstone Bicentennials, especially in Scotland, also Malawi, also in Zambia. And we in South Africa are organizing the Livingstone 200. We've already set up the Livingstone200.org website, which has got links to all the Livingstone websites around the world, his personal papers, his writings, pictures, artifacts, museums, monuments. It's a treasure trove of material for anyone wanting to do projects on David Livingstone. And we're planning a major Victoria Falls Livingstone safari to Zambia in November of this year to coincide with the anniversary of Livingstone's sighting and mapping and naming the Victoria Falls. So, by that, by way of introduction, the extraordinary life and the legacy of David Livingstone. David Livingstone was a great missionary, pioneer, pathfinder, whose greatest desire was granted only after his death. And his greatest desire was the eradication of the slave trade and the opening up of Africa to Christianity and lawful commerce. He had the grace to see that his mission was part of a divine plan, a plan to set many souls free from slavery, both physical slavery and spiritual slavery. And this was largely achieved through the work of his American convert, the journalist Henry Morton Stanley. David Livingstone was brought up in a pious but poverty-stricken home in Scotland. This, in fact, was the whole home. They were one family of 26 in the tenement, and they had this one room. There was just one bed, and under that bed were the mattresses that would come up for the rest of the family. He had two brothers, two sisters, so there were five children, two parents. So seven of them lived in this room, 10 foot by 15 feet. 10 by 15 feet. That was everything. That was the kitchen, that was the bedroom, that was what they did everything in. So this was their home. And he was brought up in this very poverty-stricken home, but his parents loved the Lord and feared the Lord. And his parents brought him up in the fear of the Lord, and he loved to read, and he borrowed extensively from the local library. They lived on the third floor of this tenement. This is what you call Shuttle Row. This is a photograph taken about 1903, before they renovated this place. But everyone here worked in the mill, and so the bell would ring at 5 in the morning to get them all ready for work by 6. By age 9, he had already committed to memory Psalm 119, the longest chapter in the Bible, and he won a copy of the New Testament as a reward. By age 10, he is employed 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. Now, most children were put to work in the cotton mills from age 6, certainly by age 8, but his parents kept him out till age 10, which was as much as they could afford, so that he could get some schooling, learn how to read first. But by age 10, he had to start paying his way, and that was normal. Of all the children who worked in a cotton mill, only 10% ever learned to read and write. David Livingstone beat the odds. He might have been the first boy from the cotton mill who went through university. He put himself through it too. But at age 10, he began to be employed from 6 in the morning till 10 at night. That's 8. That's 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. The only break ever was Sunday. There was no holiday, ever, in those 10 years. And he worked at the cotton spinning factory. He was a piecer. He had to continually rush backwards and forwards, piecing together those bits of thread that were breaking on the loom. They believed that it was essential that the temperatures be maintained roughly around 30 degrees Celsius in order to, this was good for the fabrics, it was good for the cloth, they believed. So he was effectively training in African temperatures, tropical temperatures, and he would walk an average of 34 kilometers a day. That was the average, backwards and forwards. Think of how God trained his soldier for missions. Queen Victoria said that she got some of the best soldiers out of the Highlands, because the Highlands were tough terrain and they produced tough people. And Charles Spurgeon, commenting on this and referring to David Livingstone in particular, said, God gets his best soldiers out of the Highlands of affliction. So David Livingstone, Robert Moffat, Mary Slessor are some of God's missionaries that he got out of the Highlands. The Highlands produced some fine missionaries. Tough, tough people. But think how God trained Livingstone in the town of Blantyre, which was an industrial town. Remember, Livingstone was born 1813, just towards the end of the Napoleonic Wars, before the Battle of Waterloo, in a very economically depressed time, and as the birth of the Industrial Revolution. And so society was changing dramatically. When he was born, there was no such thing as trains or telegraphs or anything like that. He went through stupendous changes in his lifetime. And unfortunately, children are getting pushed into the factories, working hard in the cotton mills, such as in Shuttle Row here in Blantyre Cotton Mill. And this was Shuttle Row, where Livingstone was brought up. And you might notice these are the staircases, these tight, round, brick, conical staircases. And there was no running water, not hot water, not cold water up there. So Livingstone got a lot of exercise also running down and up the stairs with buckets of water from the pump. Here's the pump in the yard. And that's had to service all the 24 families in that tenement, plus all the ones in the other tenements as well. And here you can see before they restored it what the tenements looked like. This was his home for over 20 years. But David managed to read in a factory by placing his book on a portion of the spinning jenny so that he could catch sentence after sentence as he passed by at his work. And he would literally get a bit here and a bit there. Do you know what he spent his first week's salary on? He bought rudiments of Latin. He taught himself Latin, then he taught himself Greek, then he taught himself Hebrew. He beat the odds. Most cotton mill boys never learned to read or write. He learned more languages than we combined in this room probably know. He maintained fairly constant study, undisturbed by the roar of the machinery. Very focused. He is considered a very antisocial boy and eccentric because of his love for knowledge. But his conversion at age 12 inspired him to resolve to devote his life to the alleviation of human misery. The book that changed his life was Practical Christianity by William Wilberforce, which explains also why he was so devoted to fighting the slave trade his whole life. The person whose book brought him to the Lord, of course, had devoted his life to fighting the slave trade. But while Wilberforce's crusade against the slave trade brought an end to slave trade in the Atlantic, Livingstone took a next step and fought against slave trade in Central Africa. This is the church that his family would walk to every Sunday in the nearby town of Hamilton. They were Congregationalists, and so they didn't go to the state church of Scotland. They went to the free church. And so they would walk to the nearby village, to Hamilton, to this Congregational church, and this is where they worshipped. And this was a wonderful church. They had a real missionary vision. They had a lot of correspondence and books and even guest speakers coming from as far afield as America, speaking about the revival fire sweeping America in the 1830s. And 1832, tremendous amounts of things happened spiritually in this church. And one of the leaflets that he picked up at this church was a leaflet written by Carl Gustloff, a medical missionary to China. And Carl Gustloff put the case for how medical missionaries can be most effective at winning the lost, especially amongst really resistant heathen, by first of all ministering to their body, then to their mind, and then to their spirit. Opening up to spiritual ministry by starting with ministering to the body. And so David Livingstone said, I must become a medical doctor. And he was determined to become a missionary to China. And so from this point, David Livingstone began to save everything he possibly could from his earnings so that he could put himself through college. There was no bursaries. There was nothing resembling a scholarship. He had to fund himself through college. When you think of people complaining about being disadvantaged today, I can't think of someone more disadvantaged than David Livingstone in his upbringing, in the poverty. When they walked to church, to show you how proud they were in a positive sense, old Scottish type of pride, they would carry their own lunch. They would not accept the invitations to the people at this place for lunch because they thought everybody is suffering in the economic depression after the Napoleonic Wars. A lot of people out of work. Soldiers came back, were put out of work. There was no jobs to be had, and people were struggling. And so they would picnic outside the church, and they would have their one treat for the week, which was a barley sweet each, one barley sweet each. That was the extent of their luxury. And they would walk backwards and forwards. Three themes dominated Livingstone's life: evangelization, exploration, and emancipation, setting captives free. He wrote at that time, we're talking about age 12 when he was converted, he wrote in his journal that the salvation of men ought to be the chief desire of every Christian. He therefore made a resolution that he would give to the cause of missions all that he might earn beyond what was required for subsistence. He reached the stage of giving 80% of his earnings to missions and living on just 20% of it, except in the last 18 months of his work in the cotton mill when he was saving up for university. Lord, send me anywhere, only be with me. Lay any burden on me, only sustain me. Sever any tie that binds, except the tie that binds me to thy heart and to thy service. And you might be interested to know that his parents completely supported him in this. His parents really loved and feared the Lord, and they were enthusiastically behind him, dedicating his life to missions, even though they wouldn't see him again. After 10 years of daily drudgery, and by the way, he got promoted to being a supervisor after 9 years. For 9 years he had the lowest job, and then he got one promotion up. David set out to study theology and medicine, first in Glasgow, and then later in London. Now, medical science in the 1830s was, by today's standards, quite primitive. They didn't have any painkillers, they didn't have any way of putting people to sleep, no anesthetics. So surgeries were performed at hazardous speeds to get in, cut out, or extract or whatever, while people held the poor patient down and they had to bite on some metal plate. Chloroform and ether were not introduced until several years later, and the discovery of antiseptics lay 25 years ahead. The study of chemistry was growing, but physics had hardly started, and biochemistry and bacteriology were unknown. Nothing at all was known about the tropical diseases, black water fever, malaria, sleeping sickness, that he was going to encounter in Africa. But he got the best medical training that you could get at that time. And I should also say that when he was studying at Glasgow, it was not too far from his home, but it was still a good 4 hours walk. And so he would every Friday walk home, and every Monday morning get up at 4 to walk to college, that he'd be there in time for 8 o'clock. And people were riding and driving that road and offering him a lift in their cart. And he would refuse, and he said, I'm training for missions. I must keep my muscles strong. I can't go to seed while I'm studying. And so he would, in the snow in winter, I believe it can be quite cold in Scotland, he walked that path and kept refusing the lifts that were offered him. It was not in Livingstone's character to relax. He took his task and his calling most seriously, and whatever he did, he performed thoroughly. He was uncompromising, diligent, and he was inflexible in his adherence to his word. Friends described him as a man of resolute courage. Fire, water, stone wall would not stop David Livingstone in the fulfillment of any recognized duty, his friend said. This is a photograph made after the time, because there was no photograph available in 1840, but of relatives who looked similar, dressed up in the same event, to recreate the London Missionary Society meeting when David Livingstone met Robert Moffat and heard Robert Moffat speak of the smoke of 1,000 villages that have not yet heard the name of Christ. And this was most opportune because at that time that Livingstone had finished his theological medical studies and he was being received as a surgeon of the Royal Society of Surgeons, and he was being ordained as a minister of the Congregational Church. At that moment, China erupted in the Opium War, and the door to China was closed. The London Missionary Society said, no missionaries to China, not possible, totally, firmly closed. And at that moment, that what he'd been planning for years for the previous 8 years, he'd been focused on China. Now, along this path comes Robert Moffat, the missionary who since 1816 has been a missionary in South Africa, and he's translated the whole Bible into the Tswana language. He's established a mission station in Kuruman. He is the LMS's premier missionary in Africa, and he comes and he gives this inspiring talk. And David Livingstone immediately switches from Asia to Africa. And praise God that he did. It took him 3 months by sailing ship to reach Cape Town, and it was over tempestuous seas. There was stormy weather just about the whole time. He described the conditions as a ship in a fit of epilepsy, flying all over the place. Their main mast split, and I had to go into Rio de Janeiro to fix their mast. While we were in Rio de Janeiro, he didn't waste his time. He was in the hospital, he was doing visitation, he was doing ministry, he was leading people to the Lord, he was praying with people who were dying. And he searched around the bush, and he managed to, he's always picking up interesting things, and he happened to pick up some quinine from quinine bush. Nobody knew what that would be good for, but he had all sorts of things that he was always experimenting on. And he later was the man who put together the idea that quinine would be the ideal antidote to malaria. Which is one reason why he survived 26 years in the field. At a time when the average life expectancy of missionaries in Africa was 8 years, in West Africa it was 2 years. David Livingstone beat the odds. And also while he was on board ship, he didn't waste his time, but he befriended the captain, and he learned from the captain how to sight longitude and latitude, how to use the sextant, how to sight by the stars and the moon, and he used his time so well that he was able to draw these maps, not because of any formal training, but because of what he learned from the captain on the 3 months coming over. He'd stay up till past midnight so he could do good sightings according to the stars at night on the open seas. And when he arrived in Cape Town, it was the 17th of March, 1841. He sailed into Table Bay. So this Sunday will be the anniversary of Livingstone's arrival in Cape Town, and Africa, indeed. But it then took, after 3 months by sea, it took another 4 months by ox cart before he even reached Robert Moffat's mission station at Kuruma, where he'd begin his work for the Lord in Africa. They went on to Algoa Bay, he got an ox cart, provisioned it, and started to go up. And he stopped on the way at what he called the prettiest town in Africa, Kraaf-Reinet. And there he stayed with the Andrew Murray family. And while Andrew Murray, that we know, would have been very, very young, Andrew Murray Sr. and his wife, David Livingstone, described as two of the most remarkable Christians, well worth going over 100 miles out of your way to meet. And he would have been in the home with this young Andrew Murray, but the father who prayed every Friday night for revival was the one that he met, and I'm sure people like that enriched his life. So he landed on the 17th of March, 1841. He is coming to a continent plagued with problems. Table Mountain looks very attractive, but behind it, no end of problems. Africa was still a place of mystery to the Europeans. Very few people south of the Sahara ventured far from the inland coast. The rivers were riddled with rapids and sandbars that shifted. You couldn't even map them. Most of the tribes inhabiting the interior were unknown. Many of the maps at that time had literally unknown and unexplored written across it. In fact, the maps at that time were embarrassing. Look at some of the early maps from the times of the Romans and see how it progressed. The Grandemere would be the Mediterranean Great Sea, Arabs, Libyans, Thebes, Ethiopians, Pygmies. They don't particularly know too much about this yet. It's not getting any better. India's out there and Arabia's there, and I'm not too sure where one ends and the other meets. Okay, here's some. How do you like that? Sea of Darkness, unknown, Negroes, Nubia. People did not know what was going on. When people called Africa the Dark Continent, it's because they didn't know what was going on yet. And here you've got a pretty ridiculous idea of what the Nile's doing. This would put the mountains of the moon and so on somewhere around Zimbabwe. This is even more ridiculous. Notice the mountains of the moon are right down about the Transvaal here. If you wonder why, when you go to the Kruger Park, they call them the Nile crocodiles, it's because people are sure the Nile came all the way down. So when they came across crocodiles, Kruger area, Transvaal, said, these must be the Nile crocodiles. But of course, they're as wrong as the people who called Tiger Valley, Tiger Valley. We've never had tigers in Cape Town. It should be leopard fillet. But obviously, some people were not too good at identifying of the animals right then. And so, even in the 16th century, you've got the mountains of the moon and the Nile River coming right down to what would be today Zimbabwe and the Transvaal. Even 1529, the maps were shocking. In fact, the general consensus of geographers was that the hinterland of Africa was desert, one big, huge, colossal desert. The Sahara stretched basically from top to toe, and it's only on the coast that you had any vegetation. The rest of Africa was desert. That was what the average geographer believed in the days of David Livingstone. He filled in the map. The deadly malaria disease was widespread, and it inhibited travel. Entire expeditions of 300 to 400 people had been wiped out by malaria. The African terrain was very difficult to negotiate. You had floods, you had tropical forests, you had swamps, all of this thwarted wheel transport, and you had the tsetse fly that killed the horses and the oxen, so you had to go by foot. David Livingstone soon acquired a reputation for fearless faith, particularly when he walked to the Barker tribe, who were so infamous for the murder of four white traders whom they mercilessly poisoned and strangled. And he was the first white man to go there since that, and he proclaimed the gospel to them very thoroughly. As the first messenger of mercy in many of these regions, he is the first one to proclaim the gospel in what today is Zambia, Zimbabwe, Malawi. He soon received further challenge. Chief Shashele pointed to the Great Kalahari Desert and said, "You can never cross that country to the tribes beyond. It is utterly impossible, even for us black men." Now, if you wanted to inspire David Livingstone to do something, you told him you couldn't do it. And that began to fascinate Livingstone, the idea of crossing the uncrossable Kalahari. He said, "I shall try to hold myself in readiness to go anywhere, provided it be forwards." He is reported to have a steadfast manner, and people knew where they stood with him. In other words, he was blunt. He was not tactful. Livingstone's plans to establish a Bible college for Africans was frustrated. He wanted to train evangelists, he wanted to train pastors, and the missionaries at the time said, "Are you out of your mind? These people are just coming out of witchcraft and animism. There is no way. This is not, you're generations away from it." And so David Livingstone was frustrated, and he clashed with every white missionary he ever came across, actually. The fact is, David Livingstone got on very well with Africans, but he never could seem to get on with whites for long at all. He was very harsh and critical and strict with whites, but he was amazingly gracious with the African people. But you can see the sovereignty of God in this too, because had Livingstone's wishes been carried out, he might have spent his life's work training in a Bible college, which would have been good. But God had another plan for him, which was to traverse Africa and to deal a death blow to the slave trade, opening up Africa to missionaries. This is Chief Shashele much later in life, one of Livingstone's converts, and the man who, in fact, so frustrated Livingstone, because he was very enthusiastic for the gospel. But when he was told that he must put away his polygamous wives, he must just be married to wife number one, send the others away, which isn't very good advice. These days, missionaries would not advise that. The way how we tackle polygamy these days is you cannot take on any additional wife. You can be baptized, you can take communion, but you cannot be a church leader with polygamy, because a church leader must be husband of one wife. And so a person who's had polygamy before his conversion can be baptized and can take communion, but he cannot be a church leader. And in this way, you are trusting that by the second generation you can eradicate polygamy. But David Livingstone was far too stringent for that. He, along with most missionaries at that time, said you've got to get rid of all your wives. And when Chief Shashele was found to not have really put them away, when one of his other ex-wives got pregnant, Livingstone literally shook the dust off his feet, and he proclaimed him excommunicated. And he, although Chief Shashele loved Livingstone the rest of his life and always counted him a good friend, that's what started Livingstone's travels. Because up till then, he had been a traditional missionary for the first 11 years of his life, establishing a mission station, working there, then going to another place. But when his primary convert backslid in his mind, he despaired of traditional missionary work, of working in one area, and he literally shook the dust of his feet and walked into the hinterland. He had three daily conditions: heat, harsh conditions, and hard hearts. Everywhere Livingstone travelled, he said he saw faces engraved on the trees, idols, sacrifices, human sacrifices, babies being sacrificed. He saw so much sign that the people lived in dread and fear, that the whole atmosphere was oppressive, because you could just see witchcraft and Satanism and occultism was keeping these people crushed and oppressed. So there's a lot of hard hearts. He said, "I hope to be permitted to work as long as I live beyond other men's line of things, to plant the seed of the gospel where others have not planted. But every excursion for that purpose will involve separation from my family for periods of 4 to 5 months. I am a missionary, heart and soul. God had an only son." And he was a missionary and a physician. a poor, poor imitation of him I am, or wish to be. In his service I hope to live, in it I wish to die. During his first missionary journey with his wife Mary Moffat, who is the eldest daughter of Robert Moffat, and Robert Moffat's wife was also Mary Moffat. Interesting enough, Mary Moffat, the mother, senior, her parents strongly resisted her marrying a missionary. Strongly, strongly. She, in fact, kept her for 3 years from marrying Robert Moffat as she wished. And interesting enough, when her daughter was proposed to and got married, she did exactly the same as her mother did. And she strongly opposed and became a very difficult mother-in-law, to the extent that when David Livingstone had to, he sent his wife and children back to Scotland rather than to his parents-in-law's home in Kuruman because of the intense opposition. Now, she'd undermine at every point his marriage. Interesting how it's almost like a generational curse you can have passing down to behave like that. But David Livingstone took his wife and children with him on all his expeditions. And in fact, Mary Moffat joined him for 3 major expeditions, going hundreds of miles into what today is Botswana, into the Kalahari. And their fourth child was born and died of malaria. In fact, every one of the children suffered from malaria. His wife came down with some paralyzing affliction, and it was, you could imagine the condition. He counted, he said there wasn't a square inch on any of their skin that wasn't covered in insect bites. And there was no water. They went for days without any water, literally days. And by the time they came back to Kuruman, he was just being berated as he came through the gate by his mother-in-law for his irresponsibility of taking a wife and 4 children on a missionary journey in the wilderness. And so he then determined to take his family, put them on the boat in Cape Town, and send them to Scotland. And he is criticized for sending his family back to Britain when he pioneered the hinterland of Africa. Damned if you do, damned if you don't, it would seem. Mm-hmm. But David Livingstone had not seen civilization in 11 years. When he came back to Cape Town in 1852, he hadn't seen Cape Town for 11 years, and he said, first sign of civilization in 11 years. Nice to know Cape Town has rated as civilization for a long time. When his wife rejoined him for his second great missionary expedition in Zambezi Valley, she died within 3 months of malaria. And you can be sure he was heavily criticized for that as well. But he said, I shall open up a path into the interior, or I will perish. May God bless us and make us blessings even even unto death. Shame upon us missionaries if we to be outdone by slave traders. The slave traders are going in these villages, missionaries should be too. If Christian missionaries and Christian merchants could remain throughout the year in the interior of the continent, in 10 years slave dealers would be driven out of the market. Parents were selling their children for a pack of needles. If we could give them something else to trade, then they would not be dealing in this trade and degrading human flesh, as he said. He battled rains and chronic discomfort and rust and mildew and rot, totally drenched, fatigued, laid low with fever. 60 times he suffered malaria. Livingstone continued to persevere across the continent. Hostile tribes demanded exorbitant payment for crossing their territory. If you wondered why the missionary columns needed to be so long and so many people having things in their head, it wasn't for their luxury, it was trading items. They had to pay to cross any chief's territory, and there were hundreds of chief's territories they had to cross. If you thought that all of these border tariffs were something of the colonials, think again. Read Livingstone's travels, it long predates it. They had to provide elephant tusks or slaves. They'd say, oh, you could just give us some of your men as slaves. Livingstone wouldn't give any of his men as slaves. When he reached Luanda, he was walking barefoot because he'd even have to give away his shoes. He was bearded for the only time in his life because he didn't have even his razor and his mirror he'd had to barter away to cross chief's territories. So hostile tribes demanded exorbitant payment for crossing the territory. He came across the Zulu. You might be surprised to know Zulus were as far up as Namibia and Angola. In fact, Katima Mulelo is a Zulu name up in what is Caprivi. Of course, you get some of the Zulu tribes still in Zambia. I've met some of them, and in Malawi. So he would meet these people who would be ready to bash people's heads in, but he managed to somehow win these people over. And he was such a linguist Livingston managed to preach the gospel to the tribes in their own language. He acquired the languages so quickly, he must have had a real gift for languages from the days of mastering Greek and Hebrew and Latin as a young child. He just acquired these languages and never seemed to use an interpreter. Tense times were stared down by Livingston with gun in hand. Trials tested the tenacity of the travel-weary team. In fact, you can see here as he's confronting Arab slave traders, David Livingston was a fearless man. He is known for his courage throughout Africa. Interesting that at the 100th anniversary of the death of David Livingston in 1973, socialist Zambia under Kenneth Kaunda's dictatorship still produced a postage stamp honoring the death of David Livingston and showing him chasing the Arab slave traders out of Zambia with this hiking stick. Open this, heal this open sore, which is the last words he wrote in his journal speaking about the slave trade. Can the love of Christ not carry the missionary where the slave trade carries the trader? These boots were made for walking. This is what David Livingston's boots looked like after his first journey. You can see a bit of extra work and patching done. And that's the signature, by the way. One of the great achievements of his first missionary journey, walking across the continent, was sighting Victoria Falls. Now, I've heard people saying, David Livingston couldn't have discovered Victoria Falls. All local people must have known about it. No, you could say he's the first European there, maybe. Well, maybe, but he certainly was the first person to sight it, to measure it, to pace it, to map it, to name it, to sketch it, to make it known. But I think he might well have been the first person to have even seen Victoria Falls. And the reason why I say this is the local people didn't actually know what was there. When he said, what is that big mist in the field? That's Musi Uratanya, the smoke that thunders. What's making the smoke thunders? Witchcraft. Don't go anywhere near there. I mean, the place is bewitched. And Livingston, of course, got on his canoe and he went off and he landed in what today is known as Livingston Island. He crawled out an edge and he peered over the edge into the most incredible cataract in the world. The longest waterfall in the world, the biggest waterfall in the world, the highest, widest that he had ever seen. And he took a lead ball on a string and he let it down and he measured. 310 feet to the bottom. Dead right. It is. He paced it 1,860 feet wide. Correct. Meters wide. That's what it is. 1,860. He sketched it. It's just an extraordinary thing. How did he do that? Because, as you can see, there's not exactly paths there. How do you measure something like this without a GPS, without satellite imagery? Yeah. But he managed to pace these out, and you can actually see his sketches. I've got a sketch right here. Livingston went to this island, and he paced, you can see. He's got 160 yards wide, 310 feet deep. That's what it is. That is what it is. Incredible. He was right. He even paced how many yards it was between the different chasms and how far deep, 400 feet deep in this case, covered with trees and so on, and 150 paces here. And extraordinary detail of this man with so little available. Now, he found such a plethora of wildlife, such a superabundance. It was like the Garden of Eden. He had never seen so many animals packed in such a small space as this. Which proves again that the local people didn't know what was there and didn't approach it. Because if they did, there would have been hunting animals there. So I think that it's very likely David Livingston might have been the first person to see it, certainly in recent times. He is certainly the first one to make it known. So this, by the way, is Thomas Baines' great portrait on a second great missionary expedition that took Thomas Baines out. And here you can see Thomas Baines' artwork so much more thorough. But even then, the animals were just immense in numbers around that area. And this is another sketch of Victoria Falls from another angle. Well, after 2 years pioneering across the hinterland of Africa, can I just point out to you, he walked these distances. We drive where Livingston walked. And he walked across an Africa that did not have roads or bridges. Every bridge makes it so easy for us to cross this river. But if there is no bridge, think how complicated it gets to cross a river. There's a lot of rivers to cross in Africa. So when somebody comes here from overseas and they say, is such and such in walking distance? You could say, yes. Everywhere's in walking distance in Africa. David Livingstone proved that.
Yeah.
The question is, do you have the time? If you have the time, everywhere's in walking distance. He walked across Africa. He reached Luanda. And the forerunner ship was ready to take him to England. There's a lot of excitement. Livingstone had disappeared for 2 years. People were wondering what's happened to him. And there was this English ship ready. We're on our way to England. We'll take you straight there. And he would have been home to a hero's welcome ready, because no one had crossed the hinterland of Africa before. This is an amazing feat. And he had so many calculations. He was guaranteed success. But the word of a gentleman bound him. He believed he had to take his men back, all the way back to the village, because they could be sold into slavery by the Portuguese. Because although the Europeans had abolished the slave trade in 1815 with the Congress of Vienna, the Portuguese were the one European nation that hadn't signed it. So Portugal still engaged in the slave trade. And rather than risk their being sold into slavery in Portuguese West Africa, he preferred to take another 2 years crossing the continent that almost killed him on his first journey to return him to safety. By the way, while he is in Luanda, he wanted to show his men how the Europeans worship. So he took them to the only kind of big church he could find, which is a Catholic cathedral. He said, okay, this isn't exactly the way we Protestants do it, but you can get an idea of this magnificent building and formal services. And his men were laughing through the service. And afterwards he wanted to know what we're laughing at. He said, I see that the white people charm their demons just like we do. The way that the Catholics were doing the different genuflections and bowing and the incense and so on. And they said, they're charming their demons just like we do. So Livingstone noted in his book that he thinks that the Protestant way of doing things very simply and with a book and prayer and hymns is better, because if the animists found too much to identify with the way the Catholics were doing it, he felt that the Reformation was well justified. Just one of his comments in his visit to Luanda. Now notice how he did an ideal cross-section of Africa, walking across it, describing that Africa's not just one big desert in the middle. It has got rainforest, it has savanna, it has got forest, there are mountains, there's so much in the center of Africa. And all the time he's describing the types of plants and flora and fauna, because he's trying to encourage people to see that Africa's got more to offer than just people, slaves. It's got agricultural potential, it's got mineral potential. And it's worthwhile noticing that if Livingstone had chosen to return home on a forerunner ship, he might well have ended his ministry in 1854. Because the ship sank with all hands lost. And his journals that he put on the ship went down too. But by God's grace, he had a copy of his journals. He had laboriously written up just in case. There wasn't a copy machine around. This is old technology. And we're talking about the pens that you dipped in ink and you sharpened the pen and with a quill. But he had written it out just in case he didn't lose his very precious calculations. These privations I beg you to observe are not sacrifices. I think that word ought never to be used in reference to anything we can do for him, who though he was rich, yet for our sakes, he became poor. Often David Livingstone endured excessive, unnecessary hardship and deprivation because he hacked through dense jungle following the Zambezi River on foot, because lack of funds prevented him the luxury of a canoe. I wouldn't have thought a canoe was a luxury. And he often saw the sickening sights of the Islamic slave trade. Burned out villages, corpses floating down rivers, long lines of shackled slaves being herded through the bush. His mere presence often sent the Yao slave raiders scurrying into the bushes. He described times when there were so many bodies floating in rivers that the crocodiles ignored them. The crocodiles had more than enough and they were just ignoring bodies floating down the river. At one occasion he described in one day that they got 80 bodies stuck in the paddles of the paddle steamer on the second missionary journey up the Zambezi River. That's how bad it was. Many hundreds of slaves were set free by David Livingstone and his co-workers. He set the captives free. He's known as a liberator in Africa. Some of the pictures of slaves left abandoned because they couldn't keep up with the slave caravans, like food for hyenas. On one occasion, a war party of Yao warriors, Muslim warriors in Malawi, attacked the missionary party. While attempting to avoid confrontation, the team found themselves completely cut off, surrounded by this aggressive, bloodthirsty mob, who were firing at them and shooting poisoned arrows at them too. And finally, David Livingstone gave the command to return fire, and the slave traders fled. This incident received a lot of criticism in England. Charles Livingstone, who normally criticized his brother, came to his defense on this occasion when he heard one outburst in Britain, and he said, if you were in Africa and you saw a host of murderous savages aiming their heavily laden muskets and poisoned arrows at you, more light might enter your mind. And if it didn't, great daylight would enter your body through arrow and bullet holes. It was Livingstone's great desire to see the slave trade ended. First, there was the internal slave trade between hostile tribes. Every tribe enslaved neighboring tribes. Then there was slave traders from the coast, Arabs or Portuguese, for whom local tribes were encouraged to collect slaves by marauding raids. Thirdly, there were parties sent out from Portuguese or Arab ports with cloth, beads and muskets and ammunition to exchange for slaves, and were chiefs so happily traded their people. In fact, slavery was seen as part of the criminal justice system. If you had someone who's a debtor or a thief or someone who just upset the chief in one way, he would be not put in prison. You got to look after him. You'd sell him as a slave to a neighboring tribe or a salesman coming along, and in this way they would be enriched. So there was a multiple level of slavery going on in Africa, and Livingstone documented, differentiated, and made this known. Incidentally, David Livingstone's attributed with inspiring the shortest war in history. In 1873, when the British Navy presented an ultimatum to the Sultan of Zanzibar to close the flourishing slave market, and when they refused, his palace was shelled, resulting in a record-breaking surrender within the hour. The white flag was raised, and all these huge underwater caves around the island were found filled with slaves who were filling the towers. Zanzibar was the terminus from which slaves were going all over the Indian Ocean areas into the Muslim Middle East. In his writings and public speaking engagements, Livingstone regularly spoke of his twin concerns: to enlighten people on the evils of the slave trade and to spread the Christian gospel amongst the heathen. And he describes a plethora of wildlife wherever he traveled. Amazing amount, huge amounts of wildlife. Now, you might wonder whether the size of the crocodiles depicted here in the Zambezi might be a bit exaggerated. Not so. Reptiles keep growing their whole life. The longer they live, the bigger they grow. And I've seen 5-meter crocodiles. They had 7 and 8 meter crocodiles back in that time, very easily, because that was before they were being hunted out. And so crocodiles did grow phenomenally large, because there's no human enemy that could have taken them on once they got to about 4 or 5 meters. David Livingstone showed tremendous respect for the local people and their customs, and he was very much one who would listen. For example, he would come to a village and he would sit outside the village and wait for the chief to invite him in. He'd wait for days if necessary. He did things in accordance with African customs, and they respected a man who respected their customs, and he would win their hearts in his way. Although he was renowned for his exploration, in his mind it was only a means to evangelization, to disciple the nations. He believed in comprehensively fulfilling the Great Commission, ministering to body, mind, and spirit. Medicine to minister the body, schools to minister the mind, churches to minister to the spirit. And missions used to always rest on these three pillars: hospitals, schools, churches. But somewhere in the 20th century, the church abandoned this comprehensive fulfillment of the Great Commission. And in most cases in Africa, it's not that the governments took the schools and the hospitals from the church, but the church gave away the schools and hospitals to the state. This is expensive. This is complicated. You take it over. Of course, in many cases, governments came and stole the church schools and hospitals, but in most cases, the churches gave them up willingly, which is foolish. The state can never do as good a job of educating the next generation or caring for the sick as the church and the missions can. And it's part of the Great Commission: heal the sick, make disciples, teach obedience. It's part of the Great Commission. Now, David Livingstone didn't just carry a Bible. He carried a surgical kit That looks a pretty ominous surgical kit. And a sextant. And he always carried his microscope, and he observed God's spectacularly diverse creation with awe and wonder. His books are filled with fascinating scientific and medical and botanical observations, anthropological observations, geographical observations, all kinds of details and sketches. The tools the people used, the different types of innovations for agriculture, the kinds of tattooing and body piercing and weird things that people put in their noses and lips and stretching their ears, the kinds of bangles they put around the ankles and the weapons that they had and the beer containers, the weird hairdressers that the people had, strange beards, this in Angola, and musical instruments that they used, in this case in Angola, some kind of marimba instrument. The kind of dances and customs. David Livingstone was observant. That's one of the most extraordinary things about him. To read his book, he noticed everything. How the bushmen transported water using ostrich eggs, make a tiny hole in the top, filling it with water, putting tufts of grass in, making nets to carry a number of them together, and this way being able to cross the desert areas. He introduced the baobab tree to people and pointed out that it's a great survival tool. You can make rope, sandals out of the bark of the tree. You can often find some stagnant water in the top that's still resting in the hollowed out area on top, which could be boiled and sieved, and you could find sustenance from that too. He sketched Victoria Falls, giving a perspective that you could not have attained because there is no hill for you to get that perspective. He imagined what it would look like a bit higher to give people an idea of the size and the scope. The vast amounts of animals, the varieties of animals, the waterbuck and the gnarler and the eland, magnificent herds. He spoke of herds of a million springbok in the Karoo crossings. And we still see some of the animals which David Livingstone came across, but not in the same numbers. He came across them in the hundreds and in the thousands, and he had on more than one occasion his boat being knocked upside down, capsized by hippopotamus. Massive herds of buffalo, colossal amounts, and yet interestingly enough, in all of his travels around Africa, he had very little problem with animals. And he learned that you leave them alone, they will leave you alone as well. Now of course some people are knowledgeable about the fact that when Livingstone was in Africa, he did have an encounter with a lion, but I should speak up for the lions and say that he picked the fight. Magnificent springbok. If you wondered why our sportsmen are called springboks, they can leap 18 meters.
Wow.
One bound. Fastest animals in the world. Extraordinary animals. And imagine David Livingstone walked around and amongst these glorious animals, magnificent creation. There you can see claws out, ready to go for the hunt. And although he went through Africa replete with wildlife, the animals didn't attack him when he didn't attack them. Now, of course, we do know about the lion incident, but the story about that was the local villagers convinced him that the lions were a threat, which is an unlikely story. With the amount of wildlife around, the fact that, you know, the idea that the lions are taking interest in their goats or cattle is next to nil. Nevertheless, I'm sure it was just the chief wanted a lion skin, and David Livingstone was too inexperienced to know better. He'd only been out here just about 3 years, and he got conned into going on a lion hunt, and he shot one of these lions while he was sitting on a rock, and no wonder the lion took him on, and crushed his shoulder, which he suffered from for the rest of his life. But in the rest of his life in Africa, he never had a lion attack him. And so the principle was, and he said it was a very imprudent decision of his, and he never tried to hunt a lion the rest of his life. So, if you know, before people start blaming lions, bear in mind, Livingstone cornered them, tracked them, and fired the first shot and drew the first blood. So, while I do admire Livingstone in many ways, that was one thing where he's wrong on, and I take the lion side. Herds of elephants. He saw herds of 400 elephants at a time. They're more agile than you think. And tremendous family structure of these. you can see the cooperation of the small animals and large animals. There the tick birds are getting the ticks off the elephant, and the elephant's happy to give them a ride. Cooperation. You can imagine how this ear must have got torn in some thorn bushes or fight maybe. You do not want to get this close to an elephant. Magnificent animals. It's hard for us to imagine what Livingston described of the absolute superabundance of animals. And those people who say, oh, the local people lived in harmony with wildlife, well, not so. Livingston depicted lots of senseless cruelty and absolutely vile practices, such as how they would in Zimbabwe just make fires and chase the animals into a huge pit. Absolutely pointless. There's no way this is good for food or anything. It's not hunting an animal for food. It's just killing vast amounts of animals for no good reason. So those people who want to say, oh, everyone lived in harmony, no, there was a demonic evil amongst people who were into witchcraft. This business that everyone lived in harmony with nature before the colonials arrived, it's just a nice story, but it's not true. He was the first to map the Great Zambezi River. We're talking about 3,000 kilometers he had to map it. And he mapped it on foot. And when you put Livingstone's map of the Zambezi, and you put that down next to the maps that we've got based on satellite imagery today, he's on target. He's pretty accurate. There's very little that you could disagree with. And how did he work out the elevations? He boiled his thermometer in the water, and he saw at what temperature it would boil. He could calculate the elevations, and hence he could work out his ideal cross sections, and he got how many feet above sea level, and so on. Walking across Africa, started from Algoa Bay up to Kuruman, went all the way up and around here in Botswana, and then finally, after taking his family to Cape Town, walked all the way up through Botswana, through Zambia, through Angola, back to Angola, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Mozambique. First missionary journey. I've driven that distance, and it's hard driving across roads. To walk it, it's hard to imagine. Here you can get a bit of a feel for Livingstone's travels into a second and third missionary journey as well. You can see the second missionary journey going up the Zambezi and up the Shiri Valley and around Lake Nyasa's. Third missionary journey going from Zanzibar, Rovuma River, Nyasa around it, and then up Lake Tanganyika into the Congo, and finally died in what today is Zambia. This gives you a bit of a feel for how Zambia, how Africa was at that time. You had the Cape Colony, you had Bechuanaland, Kamara, Kalahari Desert, and the Angolan and Mozambique colonies of the Portuguese, and not much else known about Africa. But he showed us that Africa is not one big desert in the center. It's actually a complex network of rivers and lakes, which changed everyone's perceptions of Africa and of mountains. Africa's more well-watered. In fact, we now know today that the Congo River alone has enough hydroelectric potential to provide electricity for everything in Africa needed. Every home, every industry in Africa could be supplied by hydroelectric power from the Congo River alone. And of course, we've got the Niger, the Zambezi, we've got the Nile, we've got many other rivers too, but the hydroelectric potential of Africa alone, the phenomenal lakes. This is rich real estate in terms of minerals, in terms of agricultural potential. Africa should not be needing aid from anyone. And Livingstone was one of the first scientists to make the connection between mosquitoes and malaria. And here you can see his drawing here of the tsetse fly. And Africa's got two big defenses, he said, mosquitoes and tsetse fly. That's what keeps people out and protects Africa to a large extent. And he experimented on himself. And he used the quinine. Here you can see the tsetse fly magnified. The detail. In his book, one of his complaints is that how regularly when somebody was stung or he was stung, one of his bearers would smash it. No! I want to examine this creature. Oh, it's all crushed. And he's very concerned to get this creature under the magnifying scope. And I mean, there he was drawing these details. If you wondered what he's doing at night. And this is the Livingstone Rouser, quinine and rhubarb compound, which has been found to be the primary way of defeating malaria to this day. And he was way ahead of the scientists. The scientists said malaria is caused by bad air. That's the etymology of the word in Latin, mal, area, bad air. And so the scientists of his time said malaria is caused by bad air, have high ceilings, and you'll be safe from malaria. And Livingston, 20 years before the scientific community caught up, was saying no, mosquitoes cause malaria. And the scientists were saying, what could an insect have to do with malaria? This is bad air, this has got nothing to do with insects. And then he's coming up with quinine as a solution. And the scientists are rolling their eyes, saying, what's a bush in Brazil got to do with treating malaria in Africa? But Livingston was right, and we still use it to this day. And he pointed out that not only is it caused by mosquitoes, but it's the pregnant mosquito who only lays the eggs between midnight and about 5 or 6 in the morning. So if you're under your mosquito net from about 11 at night through to 6 or so in the morning, you're pretty safe, and you might get bitten by a male mosquito, but you're not going to get malaria. And again, he has proved right. It's absolutely true. But how observant he had to have been to have noticed that. He was that observant. And it's not an accident that the tsetse fly is on the cover leaf of his book, Missionary Travels and Researches in South Africa. And by the way, before anyone gets confused, of course there wasn't a country called South Africa then. South Africa meant South Africa, like South America. So, you know, there was the Cape Colony. There didn't exist anything in realm of a country called South Africa. So when he says travels in South Africa, he's talking about everywhere from Angola to Mozambique. And on a second great missionary journey, they sent him up the Zambezi. The British government made him a consul. He got this useless boat, this paddle steamer. It was top of the line British technology, but it leaked like a sieve. And what was even worse about this hideous contraption is it took a day and a half of chopping wood for every half a day of burning the wood. The engine was the most inefficient possible. It was, he said, we deforested the areas alongside the, it was really a bad ship. There was nobody upset when it finally sank. It was a curse. And they had the dream team of Victorian England sent out. Thomas Baines, the best artist. Dr. Kirk as the medical doctor. But unfortunately, it was a disaster of a trip. The challenge of Livingston rings out to us today. Can that be called a sacrifice which is simply paid back as a small part of a great debt owing to our God, which we can never repay? It is emphatically no sacrifice. Say rather, it is a privilege. One mission organization wrote to David Livingston saying, have you found a good road to where you are? If so, we want to send other men to join you. And Livingston replied, if you have men who will come only if they know there's a good road, I don't want them. I want men who will come even if there's no road at all. The optimistic eschatology of Livingston the Liberator comes as a stern rebuke to the prevailing escapist eschatology of defeat and retreat. I don't think he would fit into the name it and claim it, health and wealth, prosperity, gospel, Willow Creek, sinner-friendly, saddleback type of prayer of Jabez Christianity of today. He was no antinomian. He was a tough Christian. Hard Calvinist, strict Scotsman, tough doctrine. He had backbone of steel doctrinally. He had a heart on fire for the Lord. He had no time for the lukewarm and half-hearted. In fact, you should read the horrible things he said about missionaries in Cape Town and missionaries up in Kuruman. He was very, very critical of the other missionaries for not being diligent enough, not doing enough for evangelism, not reaching out enough. Their strategy of ministering to body, to mind, to soul, it was all enormously successful. He combined his medical training with theological education and a vision for establishing lay leadership training centers throughout Africa because he wanted to minister to body, mind, and spirit. And his painstakingly detailed geographic research and his map making on his pioneer explorations and his published research were absolutely foundational in opening up Africa for the gospel and destroying the Arab slave trade. Yet despite the crushing losses of his fourth child, Elizabeth, and his wife, Mary, to disease in the field, and many debilitating illnesses, and attacks by wild animals, and attacks by Muslim slave raiders, and criticism from home, a lot of it, and the physical strain of hacking his way through the jungle, and walking from coast to coast, Livingston persevered. Nothing earthly will make me give up my work in despair. I encourage myself in the Lord my God. I go forward. So the tribulation so willingly endured by so many missionaries should provoke us to ask, what could have inspired them to have continued on in the face of such overwhelming obstacles and hardships? The 19th century missionaries were an extraordinary breed of people. Livingston wrote, in fact he wrote this to in a letter to his sisters, we need to be uncommon Christians, eminently holy and devoted servants of the Most High. Let us seek that selfishness be extirpated, pride banished, unbelief driven from the mind, every idol dethroned, everything hostile to holiness and opposed to the divine will crucified. Holiness to the Lord may be engraved on the heart and evermore characterize our whole conduct. We still have a debt of gratitude to Jesus. There is no greater privilege on earth than having our own chains broken off to go forth and proclaim liberty to the captives, opening of prison to them that are bound. By the way, this story here in this picture gives us a story. One is walking in Kuruman. Let me remind you, Kuruman is very close to Kimberley. He came across diamonds. He knew there were diamonds. He picked them up, he saw them off, and he just threw them in a bush. He didn't say a word of it until Kimberley was discovered as the diamond, as not the diamond rush, and then he brought it out. And people said, why didn't you make it known? He said, I didn't want to ruin the life of the people there in the environment by having these diamond rush miners pouring in here. And he said that would corrupt the local people. My job was to improve the people spiritually. The last thing I wanted was to let people know there were diamonds here. Why don't you just take a few and sell them? I mean, it would have solved a lot of your financial problems. He said, that would have asked questions. People would have thought, where did I get it from? And next thing, they would have been scouring where I'd gone, and it would have undermined spiritual work. So he knew about the diamonds before anyone else. He just threw them back in the bush. He was so observant. Of course he had noticed. He noticed everything. He was a very observant person, painstaking in everything to do with geological and flora and fauna, he would notice. So, what an interesting thing. He wouldn't allow himself to be distracted by diamonds. He was inspired by an optimistic eschatology. Like most of the missionaries of the 19th century, David Livingstone was a post-millennialist. He held to the eschatology of victory, meaning he is convinced that the Great Commission would be fulfilled before the Lord returned. He didn't have an eschatology of defeat and retreat, he had an eschatology of victory. And that inspired him. After his first great missionary journey, he was received by Queen Victoria, given awards by her, and he amused her by telling her how the chiefs had frequently asked, how many cows does Queen Victoria own? Because when he said how she's a great queen, they wanted to know, well, you know how wealthy a person is, but how many cows she owns? She found that very amusing. Here you can see David Livingstone in 1864, with the arrow pointing him with his consular hat. This was during the great debate, the Nile duel, as they called it, between Speke and Burton. And Livingstone was called in as the referee, or chairman, so to speak. So here the people are gathering for an outdoor debate on the source of the Nile. And he had just come back from the Zambezi expedition, and Royal Geographic Society asked him to please referee this colossal debate, which unfortunately did not go very far, because Speke suffered possibly an accident, maybe a suicide, but he died from a gunshot just before the main debate. He became so popular he had to rush into carriages to get away from the crowds who were after him. Discoveries and inventions are culminative, filling the earth with the glory of the Lord. All nations will sing his glory and bow before him. Our work and its fruits are culminative. We work towards a new state of things. Future missionaries will be rewarded by conversions for every sermon. We are their pioneers and helpers. Let them not forget the watchman of the night, who worked while all was gloom, and no evidence of success in the way of conversions cheers our path. They will doubtless have more light than we, but we serve our master earnestly, and we proclaim the same gospel as they will do. A quiet audience today. The seed has been sown, the least of all seeds now, but it will grow into a mighty tree. It is as if it were a small stone cut out of the mountain, but it will fill the whole earth. He's referring to Daniel 2. We work for a glorious future, which we are not destined to see, the golden age, which has not yet been, but which will yet be. We are only morning stars, shining in the dark. But the glorious morn will break, the good time coming yet. the dominion has been given by the power of commerce and population of the people of the saints of the Most High. This is an everlasting kingdom, a little stone cut out of the mountain without hands, which will cover the whole earth. For this time we work. By different agencies, the great ruler is bringing all things into a focus. Jesus is gathering all things to himself. He is daily becoming more and more the center of the world's hopes and of the world's fears. There's so much one could say about Henry Morton Stanley. Next Thursday night we'll go through Henry Morton Stanley's story. That's something in it and of itself. How he died on his knees in Zambia at age 60, 1st of May 1873. And his followers who had been rescued. In fact, Chuma had been rescued from Yao slavery in Malawi in the Shiri Valley, along with Bishop Mackenzie and David Livingston. And he served Livingston at the end of his life. The people who knew him the best were with him to the very end. Jacob Wainwright, Susie Chuma. They said, he's a great man. He must be buried with his own people. His heart belongs in Africa. So they buried his heart under a tree in Zambia, and they etched this into the tree. And then they carried his body. 9 months they carried his body to the coast. And they had to do it often at night, secretly, because if any of the chiefs knew, they would never allow dead bodies across the territory. People are so superstitious. And they risked their lives doing it because they said, he is a great man. He deserves to be buried amongst his own people. And they saw his body all the way back to Africa. Here's Jacob Wainwright at Southampton Harbour, and Susie and Chuma with the lion skin of the lion that almost killed Livingston, and Livingston's double-barreled rifle, and his sword, and his Bible, and his various tools, and his consular cap. And here they are giving to his sons and daughter what remained of their father's possessions that they'd brought all the way back from Africa. He was given a state funeral. I don't know any other missionaries ever had a state funeral. 20,000 people came to his funeral. Robert Moffat came to his funeral. And Jacob Wainwright was one of the pallbearers, and Henry Morton Stanley had the senior position at the right, front right. And Westminster Abbey is the premier place for the top in British history to be buried. And he has the premier spot right at the entrance. Livingstone's steadfast example has been used by the Lord to inspire hundreds of men and women to devote their lives to African missions, including the university's mission. Bishop Mackenzie, who was ordained in Cape Town and came out with his rapid-fire rifles, and his newsletters are filled with the shooting abilities and how many Arab slave traders he's able to take out. He is known as the fighting bishop. He really took out a lot of Arab slave raiders and freed a lot of slaves. We don't know how many people he converted, but he sure freed a lot of slaves. And other great missionaries like Mary Slessor went to Calabar, present-day Nigeria, inspired by Livingston's example. And she ended the practice of killing of twins, which the Nigerians believed to have bewitched. Peter Cameron, who was destined to found the African Inland Mission, failed on his first mission to Africa, came back and was giving up. But when he read the inscription in the tomb of Livingston, Westminster Abbey, "Other sheep I have, which are not of this fold, them also I must bring. They shall hear my voice." Mm. And he decided to go back to Africa, and he succeeded in planting the largest mission in Africa, Africa Inland Mission, which today is the African Inland Church, which is most of Kenya, and a huge amount of millions of people belong to those churches. Many people inspired. You can see here what it says here: "Brought by faithful hands of the land and sea, here is David Livingston, missionary, traveler," meaning explorer, "philanthropist. Born March 1813 at Blantyre, Lancashire." That's why they have a town in Malawi called Blantyre. It's named after Livingston's birthplace. "Died 1st of May 1873 at Chitambas village, Ilala, what today is Zambia. For 30 years his life was spent in an unwearied effort to evangelize the native races, to explore the undiscovered secrets, to abolish the desolating slave trade of Central Africa, where with his last words he wrote, 'All I can add my solitude is may heaven's rich blessings come down on everyone, American, English or Turk, who will help to heal this open sore of the world.'" And by that he's meaning the slave trade. "I beg to direct your attention to Africa," he said in his speech at Cambridge University. I know that in a few years I shall be cut off in that country, which is now open. Do not let it be shut again. I go back to Africa to try to make an open path for commerce and Christianity. It is for you to carry out the work that I've begun. I leave it with you.